The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
Start by a lift. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wiggison. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Wiggison.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our special, and it is a very special, Tuesday evening Space Show program tonight. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. So we have an hour format basically for tonight, so I'm going to really skip through almost all of the front-end stuff to spend as much time as we can with a movie star guest. I'll explain that in a minute. Toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Listeners, we're still in our annual campaign. We will be until December 31st. And we ask you for and we need your support, your donations, because we are a 100% listener-funded show. And when I tell you we need to be supported so we can produce and deliver to you incredible programming with incredible guests, you're going to hear that tonight. And I have an open line show on Sunday, and I'll tell you how this came about. And it came about because people know about the Space Show, and I got contacted. I didn't reach out to them, which is a pretty amazing story. And that's because so many of you do support and fund the Space Show, and we're able to have this kind of audience. So the easiest way to support us for our annual campaign that takes us through 2023 is PayPal. It's on the upper right-hand corner of our webpage. If you want to use a check, it's made payable to our nonprofit, 501c3, One Giant Leap Foundation. The Las Vegas address is on our PayPal button. It's also all over our website, but if you have any questions, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And you can also use Zelle, Z-E-L-L-E, if your bank uses it. Our bank is Chase Bank. And the email address, if you're going to use Zelle, is david@oneonegiantleapfoundation.org. And that takes it directly to the One Giant Leap Chase bank account. I want to get right to the program, listeners. So you can also email us at drspace@thespaceshow.com, as usual. There's a brand new film out. It's a documentary. You can watch it on Amazon Prime. I saw it last night. It is beyond words. It's beyond amazing. And it is called or titled Good Night, Oppie. And one of the stars, one of the human stars of the movie, is Doug Ellison. And Doug has been at JPL since 2010. He's been working on a variety of projects, starting with visualization projects. He was a tech director on the Curiosity rover landing animation and producer for Eyes on the Solar System and a lot of other things. And he was a big participant, as you will see if you watch this movie, on Good Night, Oppie. And he's still at JPL. And I'll let him introduce the film to you. As I said, it's on Amazon Prime. I believe it is free for right now, maybe the month of November, maybe the month of December. I'm not sure about the whole duration of the month of December. I know if you don't have a Prime account and you sign up for a Prime account, you get 30 days of free watching, and you could include Good Night, Oppie in that. I watched it on an iPhone, and the and it was fine. I mean, I'm sure the bigger screen TV would have maybe been a little bit better, but my iPhone was crystal clear and sharp as could be, and it was incredible. I watched it in bed last night, and it's 105 minutes long, and y'all need to watch it. as soon as this show is over with Doug tonight. Doug, welcome to the Space Show. How are you tonight?
I'm very well. How are you? It's great to speak to you this evening.
Well, thank you for coming in and doing this, but more to the point, thank you for spirit and opportunity and for your part in this absolutely amazing documentary. So I'll let you tell us about it and introduce it. Listeners, if you want to ask Doug questions or talk to him about the rovers, it is 1-866-687-7223 and email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Tell us about Good Night, Oppie. Give us the introduction, the 101 basics to start with, okay?
So the Mars rovers generally tended to enjoy the luxury of getting a lot of really good attention from the traditional documentary makers, National Geographic, PBS Nova. I mean, Spirit and Opportunity even had an IMAX movie made by Disney, right? But all of those, superb though they are, and they are a fantastic record. There are many amazing documentaries about both Spirit and Opportunity. But they tell the story of the rover through the eyes of the people who designed them, built them, and operated them. It's the technical story. It's the scientific story. What is so unique, and I think across pretty much any part of space exploration to date, is that Goodnight Oppie is the story of the people essentially told through the eyes of the rover. We've not really had this much care and attention given to telling the human side of these stories, what it feels like to be a part of projects as important, as long-lived, as Spirit and Opportunity. And that is why I'm so pleased that it's come out, it's come together just so beautifully, it's being so well received, and, you know, spoiler alert, right, neither Spirit nor Opportunity survived. They are both sadly no longer with us. But the way Opportunity's mission came to an end was very abrupt. It was very quick. And for those of us on the mission, it was almost like a car crash. It was suddenly, you know, we had this incredible rover. We were doing amazing science. We had loads of power. And suddenly a global dust storm comes along and bang, good night, mission is done in the space of about 10 days. And we did spend 6 months trying to recover the vehicle. But truthfully, I think we didn't really have time to process it, to understand what we had been a part of and why it was so important. And what the director, Ryan White, and his incredible team have done here is produce what I think is the emotional closure that we on the project kind of needed, but it also gives us who are on the project this incredible asset that we can hand to other people and say, you know, I've talked about the science that we've done, I've talked about the engineering involved, but this really shows you what it's like to be a part of these projects and why they're so important, why we are so incredibly lucky to be part of these adventures. It's a heck of a story. I don't think it's been told like this before, and I'm just delighted to see it out there for the world to enjoy.
Did Ryan White come to JPL and sort of pitch the idea, or how did it get initiated?
So I'm not sure the exact origins of projects like this. My understanding is that a production team approached Ryan with the idea. And, of course, the one-line pitch is a rover designed to last 90 days that survives for 15 years, right? The one-liner is a pretty good story. And so a team was put together with Ryan and his production partner to kind of pull this thing together. And then Amblin Entertainment, which is Steven Spielberg's company, were involved. They got Industrial Light and Magic involved. And then Amazon came on board to distribute it. And so you end up with this dream team. And what I've spent many hours with Ryan since the movie's come out, kind of on Q&A panels and things like that. And the dinner meeting they had to say, hey, let's see if we can put this movie together, was the day before LA County went into the first pandemic lockdown in the spring of 2020. And that made things a little difficult, but what JPL was able to provide them was thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of footage from mission control during the beginning of the mission, design and build and test of the rovers. And so during the pandemic, they could actually just go through all of this footage, find out what was interesting, find the stories that are waiting to be told, And then they, through JPL, they reached out to a whole bunch of the people involved in the mission, myself included. And we kind of did some pre-screening. We chatted with them over Zoom, as we're all used to doing these days. And then 11 of us were actually brought into studios in various places. I was filmed here in L.A. And that was actually the first time I met Ryan, was actually during the day that I was interviewed. It was about 4 hours. It was lengthy. Then I also helped with Industrial Light and Magic. So my background is in multimedia design, not really kind of aerospace engineering. But I was on calls with ILM saying, okay, here is the data from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter's high-rise camera. Here's how you can turn it into a kind of something you can animate in 3D. Here's the best versions of the data from the rover's cameras. Here's the best versions of the kind of documentation that goes with the rover day to day. All of this stuff is archived for the scientific community and the public to enjoy. And so I was just pointing ILM in the right direction. And then we kind of basically didn't hear anything because, you know, they're off doing the work they needed to do until we saw it for the first time about 6 months ago, and we were all just blown away to see it come together the way it has.
There's some things in it that really stood out that were very unique to me, and the first one is the one I asked you about before we started the show. Listeners, this is not looking at what the rovers are doing on Mars through the eyes of the rovers. It's as if there was someone standing on the surface of Mars or another rover there that we never knew about, taking pictures of what the rovers were doing and how the rovers were responding to dust storms and getting stuck in craters and doing this and that. And it was absolutely like you were there. And these were CGIs from Industrial Light and Magic, as I found out. And, Doug, I mean, I was fooled. I thought, did they have a secret rover arm that they stuck out there 5 meters from the damn rover, and they had a secret camera in there recording what Spirit and Oppie were doing? I mean, it was incredible, even getting stuck in the sand, even showing the guts of the rover covered with sand and the sand all over the paddles, you know, the solar panel. Tell us about that. That was just amazing realism.
It is extraordinary the detail they went to, and I will put my hand up and say that I kind of was giving them feedback for quite a few months. I'd get like a little preview of what the rover was going to look like, just kind of rotating on a turntable, and I'd go, well, actually, this is this color, and this would probably be more brushed aluminum, but this is more kind of mylar, and this is Kapton, and whatever, and this is composite, whatever. And I was being fastidious in my feedback, knowing that they, you know, hoping they'd be able to take some of it on board, knowing they wouldn't be able to take all of it on board. But Ryan, when he had a meeting with ILM, he quoted JPL's unofficial motto, which is their mighty thing. And special effects houses have put us on Mars in many ways. You know, there are a lot, you know, the late 90s, we had a swathe of Mars movies. We've had The Martian more recently. But they all are, for those of us who know Mars, who have lived through these missions, they're always very gratuitously the American Southwest or the Jordanian desert, right, with the blue sky edited out and the colors change a little bit. They're very gratuitously not Mars. ILM went to extraordinary lengths to build a very accurate version of the rover, to build really very, very lifelike versions of the surroundings that the rover's explored. And then they have taken some creative liberties, but the creative liberties they've taken in exactly how and what the rover does. Brutally, they personified the rovers no more than we, as those operating the rovers, would do ourselves. You know, we regularly, you know, would, and you know, use our arms or our head to anthropomorphize the rover when talking about what it's doing. And they kind of matched that. And yes, you know, the creative license is taken to the service of telling the story. But because of this being a different kind of story, I think all of us on the mission are absolutely okay with that, because it helps tell the human side of this mission that haven't really been told before. And they've done a genuinely remarkable job of really putting you right next to these two spacecraft. It is, for those of us who followed along for, 15 years, in the case of Opportunity, it is unmistakably where Opportunity spent her time. Those of us who kind of know these spacecraft, know these missions, know the adventures they went on, we can pretty much close our eyes and imagine ourselves in those locations. You know, I've seen people write stories about, 50 years from now, a school trip to Spirit's landing site and walking from where she landed to where she finished in some sort of like national park boardwalk type situation. And I can close my eyes and I can do that. I can actually walk that route because we know it so well. And ILM, frankly, they reached inside my brain and they just brought that into glorious color on the cinema screen and on Amazon Prime. It's absolutely extraordinary what they've achieved.
The second thing that I got, that I saw that the film that just was really, really fun and was the way you guys were waking up the rovers. So you got to talk about that. And
the wake up songs.
The wake up songs. And then when Hope was about to go out the window, you throw in an ABBA song and how perfect that was. I mean, it couldn't have been any more human. You couldn't have made the story any more real for people and taken it out of the context of a robot. It was just amazing.
The tradition in human spaceflight is that you have a crew wake-up song. You know, the shuttle missions had it. They would play a song down the voice loop to, jokingly wake up the crew. And the wake-up songs would be picked by the crew in advance. Weirdly, we refer to these as rover wake-up songs, but actually they are operations team wake-up songs, right? Early in these missions, you're living on Mars time, which means that what time of day it is outside the window is of no interest to you. What you care about is what time it is for the rover you're operating. And what people may not appreciate is that, generally speaking, we operate the Martian night shift. So the rover does its thing all day. It has a communications path kind of mid-afternoon, early evening. We take that data. We have until the rover wakes up the next morning to decide what we're going to do, write those commands, test them, make sure they're good, bundle them all together, and get them ready to send to the rover. And so the start of that shift is when we play these wake-up songs. And so they're actually engineering wake-up songs. But when things happen, when, anomalies occur, when you're in certain phases of the mission, absolutely we choose those wake-up songs with intent. And so when we had trouble with the Spirit rover very early on, Sol 12 or so, Sol 18, I think actually, SOS was the wake-up song. And speaking to the production team, they said that the two people who are hardest to get the license for playing music in movies are the Beatles and ABBA, and we have both of them on our list of wake up songs. But apparently, because of they approached the record labels and such, saying, "Hey, we're not picking this music for this movie. This music was played in the operations room by the team as part of this Mars rover mission, and we would like to use it in this movie." And they got yes after yes after yes, when traditionally those kinds of big bands would not give that permission. So it's really nice to be able to see that music used in the context of mission operations, picked for the reasons we picked, and all the way through to the very end of the mission when, from the engineering side, we said to the principal investigator, Steve Squires, "Hey, the very last wake-up song, we're going to let you pick it." And he picked the most beautifully apt song to close out the mission.
You have an email from Todd in San Diego, and he says, "When you say wake-up songs, is there any engineering significance? For example, is it coded and sent to the rovers in some sort of engineering language to start their activities, or is it just something that you use to signify waking up, but it's only in the control room?"
Unfortunately, it is not quite as romantic as one might hope. So it is literally just played out of a phone or, out of someone's computer speakers in the room. What we send to the rover is actually a very, very small amount of data as part of its kind of daily command. I work on the Curiosity team now. The Perseverance team is doing their job too. And we operate those two rovers in a very similar way to Spirit and Opportunity. In fact, one could say that the art of operating a rover on a tactical timeline for surface operations was learned through Spirit and Opportunity. And we actually have a very small amount of data we send to the rover each morning. It is basically, it's a shopping list of, okay, wake up at this time, do this, take these pictures, take these pictures, take these spectra, get the robotic arm out and touch this rock, put the arm away, drive over here, et cetera, et cetera. And we might typically only spend 10 minutes or so uplinking our commands at typically 1,000 bits per second. And so you can do the math. We're only sending a few tens of kilobits to the rover. So unfortunately, we weren't actually serenading the spacecraft themselves. We were just serenading ourselves.
So rover didn't hear SOS and decide to wake up then?
And sadly not. If only that were effective, we would have borrowed some very big speakers and started blasting ABBA straight towards Mars.
The film counts the days for the rovers going through their activities in their life and talks about Sol 183, Sol 27. I mean, even doing that was so unusual, but so very effective. Whose idea was that? Was that coming from JPL people, or is that part of the production team?
So we don't care what day it is, what month it is, what day of the week it is on Earth. We care about using the rover each day that it can operate. And because a Mars day is roughly 40 minutes longer than an Earth day, we call it a sol, not a day. And so you land on Sol 1, and what are you going to do on Sol 2? What are you going to do on Sol 3? And by virtue of being that little bit longer than an Earth day, that Mars time thing you have to do of basically waking up when the rover goes to sleep and being done with your work when the rover wakes up the next morning, your schedule slides, and your schedule slides by about that 40 minutes every single day, which means, let's say, just by chance, you're going to start our planning shift at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, right? Well, the day after, it's now 8:40 in the morning, then it's 9:20, then it's 10 o'clock, then it's 10:40, right? 2 weeks from now, at 8 o'clock in the morning, it's turned to 8 o'clock at night. Then another 2 weeks from now, you're now back to 8 o'clock in the morning, but you've lost an entire day by virtue of a Martian sol being just ever so slightly longer than an Earth day. And so the rover's diary, the cadence of planning, is documented in sols, not Earth days. And so when they say, you know, sol 5111, last contact from the rover, because it had survived 5111 days on the surface, but it's Mars days, which we call the sol.
Fantastic. You have another question. This is Paul in Denver, Colorado, and listeners, our phone line is available if you would like to use it, 866-687-7223. And he says if some humans got up to Mars and went to either of these rovers, could they restore them? Is their hardware still usable, or are they completely kaput from top to bottom?
So the good thing is we can get them a latitude and longitude down to, you know, as many decimal places as they want. We know exactly where they are. The unfortunate thing is that whilst we know both rovers are no longer functional, we don't know exactly why.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about Opportunity, for example. We had a very healthy rover. It was showing signs of age, right? The flash memory on her flight computer was getting pretty unreliable, so we weren't using that anymore. One of the two spectrometers on the end of her arm wasn't working. Our infrared spectrometer up on top of the mast wasn't great, but it was still a very functional rover with some scientific merit. And so when that dust storm hit, we were hopeful that when the dust storm cleared, the rover might wake up and start talking to us again, and it never did. Now, one can conjecture what might be to blame. It might be that many, many months of being freezing cold and without power because it was in the dark, maybe the battery just failed. You know, if you get lithium-ion batteries cold enough, bad things happen to them, they fail. And even when you try and put electricity back into them, it doesn't take it. or maybe it was some of the solder joints on the printed circuit boards. Maybe some critical solder joint failed going through colder temperatures than it was designed for. One could conjecture all sorts of different failure modes. And it's likely that the Spirit Rover that had, it was, you know, was going into a local winter and again was kind of browning out and we hoped would come back some months later. It's likely they probably had a similar fate. Maybe it's the battery. Maybe it was something to do with the avionics. By all means, take a sack of wrenches and a knife fix-it screwdriver set. But I'm not sure exactly what is going to be still of use on the rovers. Personally, we often get people saying, we should bring these rovers home. We should have them in a museum. And I like to reply with the, well, actually, they are home. They are where they were designed to be. And they always operated much more happily on Mars than on Earth. But for the rovers, Earth is way too hot, right? Like, the cameras don't perform very well when they're that hot. The actual avionics would overheat if you use them too long on Earth. And so we do have a spare Spirit and Opportunity. It was our test bed rover that was pretty much an exact facsimile of the real rover. And that's the one that is now here on Earth and spends its retirement at the Air and Space Museum in the National Mall.
Do you think that the design in why did it last 15 years? I guess that's my question. You thought that the life expectancy would be 90 days, and it goes for 15 years. Is it the materials? Is it what caused it? How did that happen? I mean, that's a huge increase beyond the expectation.
Yeah, it's like getting your car's 3-year warranty and having it run for a century and a half, right?
Uh-huh.
Without any servicing, bear in mind, right?
Right.
So I can bring up the paper, the canonical paper written by an engineer who's sadly no longer with us, called Jake Machiavik, who did the analysis on how long these rovers would last. And he did an analysis of all the finalist candidate landing sites, of which Gusev Crater and Rodiani Planum were two of about four or five. And then if we sent the Spirit rover, which launched first, to one of them, or we sent the Opportunity rover, which launched second, how long they were likely to survive. And there were some mildly conservative assumptions made as part of that analysis. How warm it was going to be, how well the rovers would keep themselves nice and toasty, how much power we're going to be needing to keep the rover awake, how much data we're going to be getting home from the rovers. And the one factor that we didn't have a handle on, because no solar-powered mission had tried to survive that long, was what the dust would do to the solar panels. Now, we had data from the Pathfinder lander, and after 83 days, what we saw was essentially this flat slope, this slope of a little bit more dust, a little bit more dust, a little bit more dust. We didn't see it kind of really take a turn. We didn't see it flatten out. We didn't see it get cleaned anywhere. We just saw the solar panels, both on Pathfinder and its little rover Sojourner, just get a little dustier and dustier for 83 days, and then we lost contact with the mission. And we used that dust accumulation with a bit of margin as a, okay, this is what's probably going to take these rovers out. And the numbers, you can actually look them up. The numbers were that the Spirit rover would last for 93 days if taken to Gusev Crater, and the Opportunity rover would last 100 days if taken to Meridiani Planum. So in terms of meeting that 90-day requirement, we were cutting it fine. And then Mars was just more graceful than we expected over that longer time frame. So we had fairly regular cleaning events that would clean the dust off the solar panel. The rovers were a little better at keeping themselves warm than we expected. They were a little more efficient than we expected. The solar panels generated a little bit more power than we expected. And all those things come together to mean that until Mars basically says, okay, you're done, you end up with this platform that can just keep going and going and going and going. Now, the requirement was 90 days, so there were things that we tested, as we typically do at JPL, for three times the required life. So there were you know, the batteries should, you know, were certified to handle, you know, 270 charge cycles, or the cameras were designed to survive 270 thermal cycles, et cetera, et cetera. But we thought the dust was going to take him out, and in both cases, like, it's not really the dust on the solar panels that was the end of the mission. It was particularly poor pointing and winter for Spirit, and it was a global dust storm for Opportunity. What's poignant, almost kind of hauntingly beautiful, is an image from the high-rise camera on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, where you can see the Spirit rover even now, and it is gleaming. Like, there's been photographs where it is gleaming clean. It is shiny. Like, we can see the sun glinting off the solar panel. So we know that the Spirit rover has, at least at some point since it died, been beautifully clean. And just because of the way the Opportunity is parked, unfortunately, we're never going to get a photograph like that just because of the angle the Opportunity is parked. But we have every reason to think that the Opportunity rover has been cleaned at some point as well. And, you know, where it's still functional, it would probably have enough power to keep going. But it was this story of dust. It's just not what we had a handle on. And we've learned a whole bunch about it since then. Now, I will say, you know, I jokingly refer to InSight as our friends in the north from the perspective of the Curiosity mission. The InSight mission has not been that lucky. It really hasn't received those cleaning events. And they didn't go into their prime mission relying on that being a thing that would occur. And so they scaled their batteries, they scaled their solar arrays to be big enough to get through their prime mission with a bunch of margin without requiring that. And so it has come to pass. They're now an incredibly filthy spacecraft, but they're just getting by. Who knows how long they have left? Probably not much longer, but they've lasted more than, you know, twice the design requirement. I think Spirit and Opportunity perhaps have unfairly raised the bar to a ludicrous degree for how long missions should last. But it's that dust story. We thought we knew how the dust story would play out, and we were fortunately incredibly wrong.
Do you have something like windshield wipers or fans that can blow dust off of the panels or other sensitive equipment? Is there any internal self-cleaning?
So dust can't really get inside. We actually... There's a realization you have about spacecraft when you start thinking about dust getting into them when they're on Mars, which is when a spacecraft is sat on a launch pad, when that rocket takes off, you've got about 3 minutes for all of the air that is inside all the cracks and crevices and between the circuit boards, right? All that air has to get out, because 3 minutes from now, that thing's going to be in a hard vacuum, and if the air hasn't come out, it's going to pop like a balloon. Right?
Uh-huh.
And so you design into these spacecraft pathways for air to get out, but you put HEPA filters in there so the dust can't get back in again. And so if you look closely at the cameras, you'll see they have these funny little black circles on the electronics boxes. And those little black circles are where the air could come out. There was a HEPA filter so dust wouldn't get back in again. We don't have any intentional dust cleaning mechanism. You know, one could formulate... like those old school overhead projectors with the rolls of acetate that you could roll over, right? A bit like the little plastic screen they have on the onboard cameras of racing cars. When a bug sprats on it, they can just wind it over to get a new view or something like that. Or maybe, you know, you could tilt the solar panels up and shake them or something, or put some sort of brush on the robotic arm. And all of those, you know, perhaps they would help get the dust off the solar panels. But they all come with their own risk. They all come with their own map. They all come with their own cost. They all come with their own volume. They all come with their own complexity. And so what we typically do is go, okay, let's scale this power system to guarantee we're going to get what we need, and then let fortune give us what it's going to give us beyond that. The one I like is the notion of kind of an ultrasonic vibration on the solar arrays that kind of quasi-levitates the dust. And so you turn that on for a few minutes, and the Martian wind gently carries it away. And I believe the Rosalind Franklin ExoMars rover in Europe, they've got some downtime while they figure out how they're going to get that to Mars. I think they're going to take into consideration some version of doing that to hopefully prolong its life. But we didn't really have room for windshield wipers or something like that. And ultimately, it wasn't the amount of dust on the solar panels that took the spacecraft, the Spirit Opportunity, out. It was just the conditions on Mars.
You have another email. Sherry is in Seattle, and she says, if somebody finds these rovers in the future, either near term or who knows, maybe 100 or 200 years ago, and they picked it up or started to looking at it, would there be a tag or something on it that says Made in America by JPL?
So they do have a NASA meatball. They do have a JPL logo on them. But the thing that I like that is on board both of these rovers is our color calibration target. The pan cameras, the color cameras on these rovers.
Uh-huh.
And we have a calibration target on the back of the rovers that I will credit Bill Nye, who I happen to be hanging out with literally just 48 hours ago. We were on a post-screening Q&A panel about the movie together. Bill Nye is the one who saw an early design of this calibration target, and he said to Jim Bell, the head of the cameras on these rovers, he said, that's a sundial. You've got to turn this into a sundial, right? And technically it's a Mars dial, right?
Right.
And so in the process of turning what is essentially a series of concentric rings from kind of white through gray to black with some reference colored chips in the corners, and then what is known as the gnomon, which is the mast, the little stick that sticks out the top of the calibration target, he turned that into a sundial. And sundials have furniture. They have decoration, right? They have embellishment. And so little messages are actually etched around the base of the sundial. And I think there's some different language in there. Actually, on the concentric circles on the deck of the rover, on the deck of the little calibration target, it shows the position of Mars and Earth as they were at the time of landing. And I think one of the messages is something like, these rovers were sent from Earth to explore Mars. For those who visit, we wish you the joy of exploration, something like that. And so I all credit Bill Nye into having kind of our own little Martian version of kind of the Voyager record to a certain extent. It's a message from this project to those fortunate enough to come by them in the future.
Could a human pick the rovers up on Mars, actually physically pick them up and carry them someplace?
Probably. I mean, they, on Earth, 183 kilograms. Let's convert that down to Martian gravity. They're going to feel like they only weigh about 60 kilograms, pretty heavy, you know, 130 pounds or so. So heavy, but not overly heavy. It's pretty hard to actually get a grip on them because the solar panels are pretty flimsy. But I bet you with two people, one grabbing the front wheels, one grabbing the back wheels, you could probably cart off a Mars exploration rover if you were doing something nefarious with it. The testbed rover, we actually had literally just some bolts on the deck. And we could actually move it using a small crane if we needed to move it around our indoor Mars yard for testing. And when we finally crated it up to ship it to the Air and Space Museum, we actually drove it onto the pallet to which it was then bolted down and then shipped to the Smithsonian. So we didn't even use a crane actually to pick it up and put it on its final resting place. We actually drove it onto the crate that shipped it out. But I think with a bit of help, you could probably move one of these rovers. But be careful, just in case it wakes up and starts to fight back.
Bill is in Houston. He says, I've also seen the film. How accurate were your simulations in the JPL Rock Garden when you had to go there with your rover there to work out a solution for Mars? Was it very accurate? Were you still taking a chance that it wouldn't work on Mars? How accurate was your rock pile simulation to the real thing?
But there's a variety of different, I'll use the phrase terrestrial analogs, right, that we've assembled to try out the testbed rover. And we actually have, and this is as true with Curiosity and Perseverance as it was with Spirit and Opportunity, we have two versions of testbed rovers. We have ones that are fully fledged, like they have all the bells and whistles, right? They have all the cameras, they have the camera mast, the antennas, everything. And then there's one that's more like a stripped out, Curiosity, we called it Scarecrow, such that it weighs on Earth roughly what the real one does on Mars. It turns out that actually doesn't have quite as much influence on the efficacy, but the accuracy of the driving as you might expect. Because while, yes, you're now trying to move a heavier rover, you also got better ground pressure per wheel, which means you're getting slightly better traction. So it actually kind of all comes out in a bit of a wash to a certain extent. But we did use both the full-up testbed MER rover and the slightly stripped-out version that was more Mars gravity-like on a variety of environments, the first of which was the slopes that we knew we'd encounter when we wanted to go into and out of Endurance Crater. These rovers were never designed to climb particularly steep slopes. That was not something we thought of. And so when we mapped Endurance Crater and saw slopes of 25, 30 degrees or more, we then cobbled together a rough analog of that kind of slope on Earth using crazy paving, sand, even had grad students gluing BBs onto the surface of these rocks to roughly emulate the blueberries that we discovered on the surface of Mars, these small, round, hard hematite concretions that were eroding out of the rock. And we were driving the rover, once we figured it out, we were driving the rover up slopes deeper than we could walk. And what's funny is if you look closely in the footage of that testing, some of it's online, there's also some in the movie, you'll see the engineers are roped up, but the rover isn't, for health and safety reasons. And they both rovers on Mars, but also in our testbed, successfully climbed slopes over 30 degrees. I think 32, 34 degrees might be the highest slope we climbed, which is pretty remarkable. Yeah, you get wheel spin, right? You get some slippage. Sometimes you might say, hey, go 1 meter up that slope, and you might only make it 5 or 10 centimeters, but you make progress. The tougher problem was when we had embedding events, when Spirit got stuck towards the end of her mission in what was basically a small, shallow depression filled with very, very fluffy dust, more like kind of corn flour, really, is what kind of the consistency. And then Opportunity had an embedding event in a sand dune. And in both cases, it was really hard to try and match the way that material behaved and the way it interacted with the rover's wheels. We came up with a formulation. A close friend of mine, Kim Lichtenberg, she came up with what has been forever now known as KimSim. And KimSim is, roughly speaking, it's equal parts clay sand, diatomaceous earth, and clay. And that gets you this pretty fine dust that pretty well emulates the kind of terrain that Spirit got stuck in towards the end of its mission. And some of the techniques we came up with, because we had things like, we had like some of the drive motors failing, we had steering actuators failing, we ended up almost kind of trying to swim our way through this dust. Some of the techniques we learned actually worked on Mars. Some of the things that we knew would make it worse also made it worse on Mars. But it's almost impossible to exactly recreate, the interaction between wheel and soil. But we certainly learned an awful lot. I mean, with Opportunity in that large sand dune, what we really learned is that the way to get out was the same way it got in, which was a huge number of wheel revolutions. And so we stuck it in reverse and gunned it, rover speed, which is a couple of centimeters a second, right? Over a period of weeks, we'd send command saying, hey, back up 20 meters and we might get half a centimeter or a centimeter of progress, right? But generally speaking, those analogs that we built here on Earth were pretty instructive. We learned the tips and tricks that were going to get us unstuck. With Spirit, I don't think there's anything we could have done to get unstuck from its final resting place. And we tried everything, and I think, terrestrial analog or not, sadly, Spirit was very firmly stuck when that mission came to an end.
Too bad. So, are newer rovers going to Mars? Aside from the instrumentation, in terms of endurance and maneuverability, what do they have on them that's a step above what Spirit and Opportunity had?
I think we should credit Spirit and Opportunity with being quite as remarkably mobile and agile as they were. you know, they can drive over something up to the size of their own wheels or not even notice that it's there. The suspension system, this kind of passive rocker bogey suspension system, is remarkable. And it was developed at JPL in the kind of late 80s, early 90s, and it's been used by every rover since. With Curiosity and Perseverance, the main thing you get is scale, right? Like, if you look at the size of the wheels, the little Sojourner rover from 1997 had wheels that are 12.5 centimeters in diameter. You get a Spirit and Opportunity, they're exactly double that. They're 25 centimeters in diameter. And you get a Curiosity and Perseverance, they are 50 centimeters in diameter. And in doing that, you know, the bigger you get, then the fewer rocks you care about, right?
Right.
If you can only drive over something that's 12.5 centimeters or 25 centimeters across, there's a lot of that around. But if you can ignore that stuff and now you're looking at 50 centimeter stuff, Mars becomes a little more benign. And so we've actually climbed, I think with Curiosity, we've climbed slopes that matched that of Opportunity. But I don't think we've really exceeded it, because the laws of physics really start saying, hey, at some point you're just going to, you know, just, there isn't anything you could do to climb a steeper slope than this, or climb through gnarlier terrain than this. And so scale is the thing that really has given us kind of enhanced mobility. And then with both of these newer rovers, the power story is significantly more simple. We have an RTG, a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, the same kind of power supply that operates the two Voyager spacecraft. And so, yes, we know that those RTGs get tired and eventually the spacecraft will absolutely expire through lack of power. But we don't have to worry about the seasons. We don't have to worry about finding a slope to park on during local winter. We know how much power that RTG is putting out today, tomorrow, next week, next year, 5 years from now. And so we can plan longer term, knowing that our power story is going to be a more reliable story to go with it.
But they don't have solar arrays with RTGs, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we just have the MMRTG, the multi-mission radioisotope thermoelectric generator, what I sometimes refer to as the radioisotope junk in the trunk. And it's very, when you look at them, there's very obviously this big white thing sticking at the back of each rover. And when they land, you're getting about something like 100 watts or so out of those batteries. So with these newer rovers, you're looking at something that weighs about a ton, about 7 feet tall, and you're running everything, computers, cameras, instruments, radios, everything, off something a little less powerful than the average charger for a laptop.
How do you make it so efficient, and especially compared to what we have around our house or our office?
So what we do is we model how much power everything is going to take incredibly closely and remarkably well, actually. And so with, let's take Curiosity. Our power output these days is about 80 watts or so, something like that. And so in a given day, you're going to get about round number 2,000 watt hours of electricity in a given day. And we actually spend most of our time napping. I'm not completely fast asleep, but napping with some low-level stuff still going on. And so the rover will wake up at about 9:30 in the morning, rover time. It will wait for its new commands from Earth, and then it will start running those new commands. And those new commands on a typical day will be take some images of your surroundings, get the robotic arm out, look at one of the rocks right in front of you, and then maybe it's leave the spectrometer on the end of the arm down on that rock. We'll then turn the rover off, but the spectrometer is still running in the background, consuming just a couple of watts to do it. Then we will wake the whole rover back up again. We'll reset the spectrometer. We'll start collecting data again. We'll put the rover back to sleep. Right? Spectrometer's still chucking along. The weather instruments are still chucking along. The radiation detector we have on Curiosity, RAD, that's still ticking along. And then we'll wake the rover up. We'll get the robotic arm. We'll put it away. And then we'll put the rover to bed for the night. And the rover will just nap through the evening, trickle charging its battery, its chemical battery, off the RTG in the back of the rover. And then we'll wake up to communication passes as these orbiters come overhead that we use as relay satellites. And then we'll map between them. We'll wake up the next day, and maybe it's okay. find it up sticks, get on the road. So we'll take a few more pictures. We will start driving. We'll drive for, you know, an hour or two. We'll cover 40, 60, on a really good day, maybe 75, 80 meters in a day with Curiosity. Perseverance can go quite a lot further, actually. And we'll take all the imaging we need at the end of a drive to document our surroundings, figure out where we're going to go next, figure out what the science team want to go look at. And then guess what? We put the rover back to sleep again, and we start napping. And so, much like an elderly cat, our Mars rover spends an extraordinary amount of time just quietly napping to preserve energy.
Here's a fun question for you, Allison. Allison's in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We've got a caller on hold. I'll get to that in just a minute. Allison's in Albuquerque, and she says, I too have seen the film, and it is outstanding. And I'd like to know, did all of you at JPL who had screen time write your own words, or were you given a script?
It's a good question to ask, Allison. Everything I said was completely off the cuff. It was just a conversation between Ryan and myself. There was no script. I didn't even know what he was going to ask in advance. I'd had a kind of a screening interview with some of the production team in advance, and when all 11 of us who were in the movie, we all had. We had chatted to some of the production team so they could get an idea of how good we are at telling stories, how well we can craft kind of a storyline, how well we convey the emotion involved, how, you know, good we are at being on camera. But we didn't speak to Ryan, the director, until the morning of the interview. And I remember going into that interview not knowing how big a deal, how big a production this was.
Uh-huh.
And so little old me, I drive over to the studio on the other side of L.A. I arrive like 5 past 8 or something like that. And I'm ushered into hair and makeup. I'm like, oh, wow, this is quite a big deal. I get hair and makeup done. And then I go into the sound stage, and I'm like, oh, damn, this is big. Because there's about a dozen crew, right? There's 2 cameras. There's lights. There's a sound guy. There's the director, Ryan, sat in a chair. I can just see him behind one of the cameras. And there's about a dozen people, this whole sound stage. And I remember when I was done, I was leaving at lunchtime, and Abby Freeman, who's also in it, who I still get to work with every day on Curiosity, and she's an awesome scientist, so it's a joy to work with her on Curiosity as well. I said to Abby, I went, Abby, this is a really freaking big deal. You're not going to believe what it's like in there. And she goes, and she's like, oh, damn, this is big, right? But there was no script. We were giving off-the-cuff comments in response to the questions that Ryan was asking. What's interesting is that they then took all the words that we said, and they had to then write a script using all of the words that we had said so that ILM could then storyboard all of the visual effects they had to go and make to help tell the story. So weirdly, it all came backwards. We told the story, that got turned into a script, that got turned into the visual effects, but then became the whole movie.
So the director of the project, I forget her name, but she had a lot of screen time. And toward the end, she was also very emotional. That was all her off-the-top words?
Yeah, I mean, you may be talking about Abby Freeman. Abby, who was remarkably a high school intern on the project when Spirit and Opportunity landed.
Well, she was one, but who was your main
And there was also Jennifer Trosper, Jennifer, who was an manager with Spirit.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I was with Abby and Jennifer Sunday evening for a screening here in L.A. That was us speaking freely on, you know, just being asked questions and giving our best versions of answers.
How many takes?
How many takes? actually, not many. Like, I think maybe one. And I was told, you know, if you want to have another run at it, if you want to try and capture something again, just say, I'm going to try that again and then have another go at it. But honestly, it was legit just like a 3-hour-long conversation. There were a huge number of people involved in missions like this. You know, Steve Squires' book, Roving Mars, which is about the conception and build an early mission operations of Spirit.
Right.
He made an effort to try and write the names of everybody involved in the project at that point in an appendix on his book. And it got to like 3,000-plus names, and it's not even complete, right? Thousands of people are involved in making projects like this work. And for those of us who are blessed with the gift of the gap, I refer to it, you know, we're good at telling these stories. We're good at stringing together a plot line and explaining what we do to the public. We're very fortunate to be able to help share this story on behalf of the whole team. So there's 11 of us in the movie, but for each of us, there's 30, 40 people in the background who aren't on camera, who are all just as important part of the story.
Let's see who your caller is. Good evening, caller. Welcome to the program tonight. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Dr. Sherry Bell, and I'm in Las Vegas.
Hi, Sherry. Welcome to the show. Thank you for telling me to watch it last night.
Yeah, right. I know. Well, I'll get to that, you know, and tell you why I told you, and I'll tell the whole audience about it. But firstly, just thank you, thank you, thank you for not you, your guests, for building the rovers and for doing this just absolutely wonderful thing for humanity, really, for all of us.
You are very welcome. It's truly we are truly fortunate to be on like the frontier of the human experience and to work on projects like this. It's absolutely a pleasure.
Absolutely, yeah. I'll tell you, yeah. So I have about 4 points I'd like to make. First one was to thank you. The second one was I just was thrilled by this in the movie itself, where you had it almost like a Star Trek, you know, with a Kirk and a Scotty moment, like, you know, we got to have it in 2 minutes type thing, you know, and Scotty's like, I've got to do it. And that was when the Opportunity was driving into the Endurance crater. And, you know, it was really similar to a Star Trek thing, but it stopped, a few centimeters from the boulder, just in the nick of time. It was sliding down, and it stopped in the nick of time. That really happened, didn't it?
It did. We can make our rovers braver or more cowardly based on how harsh we think the terrain is going to be. We can say to a rover, hey, just close your eyes and go. It's going to be fine. Or we can say, hey, you need to keep a very close track of exactly where you're going. And if you get outside of this particular box that we think is good, we're going to need you to stop, right? And that's what Opportunity did. It was tracking its progress as it went into this crater. And it noticed that it was getting further and further away from kind of the expected path. And we literally have things called keep-in, keep-out boxes. We literally, when we send commands to the rover to have a drive, we say we want you to get from here to there, but we then draw a box around it and say, hey, if you get outside this box, stop, because you are not in the right place. Bad things are likely to happen. And that's exactly what the rover did. It spotted that it wasn't in the right place. It was way outside our comfort zone. And so it stopped, said, you know what, I'm done. I'm not going any further because you told me that here be dragons. So we're going to stop right here. I'm just going to take all the pictures I need so you guys can plan what happens next, but I'm going to call it right here. And that has saved us on all of our rovers on many, many occasions.
This one was saved just in the nick of time, mere centimeters away. I thought that was impressive. So there's another thing that I was really impressed by in the movie itself, the way that it showed that it inspired quite a few young people to pursue careers in space-related endeavors, and I think that was just fabulous that was included in the movie. And as a matter of fact, fabulous that, you know, at least was it one or two of them that actually did, I remember one of the females came as a high school student and later ended up working on the project.
Yeah, both, I think that's true for both Becca and Abby, actually. And even Moo, who was right at the end of the movie. Abby was a high school intern on landing day, and her career took a hard turn to be involved in Mars stuff, and she ended up as our deputy project scientist for the last 3 years of the mission. And she actually made a map of Opportunity's traverse, all 40-plus kilometers of it. And instead of saying, you know, Sol 106 we got here, Sol 500 we're here, he wrote, Abby goes to college, Abby starts postgrad, Abby starts her doctorate, Abby joins the project as deputy project scientist. It's amazing. Becca, she was inspired into this industry through seeing Spirit and Opportunity. I've spoken to Ryan about this, and Ryan will always, when we're doing these Q&A panels, he will always poke me to tell my origin story, which is that I don't have an aerospace background at all. My background is in multimedia design, and I was following along these rovers through their images that Steve Squires and Jim Bell decided would go to the public in real time. You know, when the images reached the ground here on Earth, they were put online for the public to look at, such that if the time zones worked out, there was a chance that me, living back in the UK as I did at the time, I could see the pictures before the scientists did, because that's just how the time zones fell, right? And so I started playing with these images for fun, as an amateur, from the outside looking in, and making mosaics and movies and panoramas and stuff like that. And a community of people built up around doing that. And eventually, Steve actually emailed me a year or two into the mission, and he's like, love what you guys are doing with our stuff. We met a few times, and then I met some people at JPL, and they said, you've got to come visit JPL. So I came and visited JPL and talked about what we amateurs were doing with all of their data. And then that resulted in me getting a job offer in 2010 and moved over here to work at JPL in the education and public outreach side of things, in data visualization. And then I moved into mission operations, weirdly, to Curiosity first. I actually started mission operations on the Curiosity rover in 2016. And then I called Steve's bluff. He had jokingly said to me many years before, if you ever want a job on a Mars rover, drop me an email. And so I did. I certified to operate cameras on Curiosity, and I emailed Steve and said, you always joked that I could ask you for a job if I was interested. Hey, can I come play with the cameras on Opportunity as well? And to his credit, he onboarded me to the Opportunity rover, and I got to play with Opportunity for about the last 18 months or so of the mission. And unbeknownst to me, I ended up taking the last pictures with the navigation cameras and rear hazard cameras on Opportunity. And to be a little piece of this story right at the end, and to be able to reflect on just the breadth and depth of influence these two little scrappy rovers have had on my life was extraordinary. Like, I moved to L.A. I met my wife. We have a daughter who turns 5 in 3 weeks, all because of these rovers. And so dozens and dozens of stories like this.
Wow. This is excellent stories and excellently told. I you know, I saw you were going to be on David's show, and I wanted to see that thing, and I wanted, you know, to talk to you and listen to you mostly, you know. And so I watched that. I watched it, and I went outdoors. It was night. I watched this movie, and I went outdoors, and I started crying. I was looking up at the stars, and I just started crying for joy. With the joy and the pride of it. You know, it's just like, this is the best of humanity. This is the best we are. You know, oh my goodness. I'm sorry, but yeah, that's how I felt.
No, I know exactly how you feel. It takes a level of teamwork. It takes us working together. None of these projects are the work of a single human, right? They take a huge amount of collaboration, teamwork, and it's really natural to feel a collective sense of pride in humanity coming together to do projects like this. For what it's worth, I'm actually sat in my car because of the 4-year-old since turned 5 who's actually got the sniffles inside the house. So I'm sat in my car, and I can look out my windshield right now, and about an arm's width just below the moon, I can see Mars right now, and looking at a Mars clock, because, you know, there's an app for that, believe it or not. I can tell you that right now, the Spirit rover, it is about 3:30 in the afternoon. For Curiosity, it's about 1:45 in the afternoon. Opportunity's on the far side of Mars right now, but Spirit is on the side of Mars that's facing us right now. So I can see this. It's hauntingly beautiful ochre kind of star set up there. That's Mars right there, and Spirit is right there. You know, we had an amazing adventure together in the those two rovers are still sat up there, kind of marking the end of those adventures.
Oh, wow. I'm going to go outdoors after I hang up from here. I'm going to go out and look at it. Because I'm in Vegas. You're still in Los Angeles, correct?
Yep. I'm in
Pasadena.
About 15 minutes east of downtown L.A.
Yeah. Cool. Well, anyway, I thank you. Thank you so much for this. And thank all of you. What did you say? 3,000 of you.
I am but one of us. I'm so pleased you got so much out of it because for those of us on the project, it's really nice for people to get that, like, even though these are robotic missions, they are human endeavors. And it seems like you really picked up on that. And that's the piece of this that I think is we're delighted to see resonate so well with people.
Right. Right. Okay.
Thank you, Sherry.
Bye.
I appreciate it, Sherry.
So, oh, wait. There was one more little question I had for him. Are you the one who suggested the selfie?
Yeah, that was my dumb idea. Yeah. So,
I thought I recognized the photo, but the photo was so tiny. Yeah.
Yeah, that's me. So with Opportunity, they actually took one image of the top of the camera mast many, many, many years ago, in about 2007 or so. And I saw that one image, and it was just an engineering exercise to see if one of the actuators up on top of the mast was behaving properly. And I thought, oh, we should take more of those, because if we do that, we can end up taking a selfie. Now, the word selfie didn't exist back then, right? We weren't,
right.
We haven't moved on to cell phones with front-facing cameras. And fast forward about 10 years, and it was Sol 5000. And we're like, we need to do something cool to celebrate Sol 5000. And I jokingly said a few days before, we should take a selfie. And Ashley, who's also in the movie, Ashley Stroop, she's our rover driver lead on Curiosity now, but we worked together on Opportunity as well. I will credit her with taking my silly suggestion and then looking at the rover driving tool to see if it was going to be even possible to get the microscope to turn around and take those images, and reaching out to the lead scientist for planning on Sol 5000, a member of the, again, the Curiosity team now, Eileen Yinks. And Eileen said, let's see if we can make it happen. And the tools were not designed to figure out how to make the microscope point back at the rover, but Ashley and her colleague, Paolo Baluta, who is also a rover driver, still holds cumulatively the off-planet driving record with all the Mars rovers he's worked on. We figured out how to do it. And we actually added an extra couple of frames. It was really funny. We took as many frames as we thought we could take, and Ashley was kind of mad that there was a little bit. She was convinced we could do more frames. So about a week later, we took an extra couple of frames and added them onto the bottom row. So the final selfie is kind of sold 5,000, I think 5,006, 17 images in total. But it was really nice. And it's fuzzy, and it's gray, and it's out of focus, and it's small and low resolution. But it's one of the most fun things I think we ever did with either of those rovers.
Yeah, that was just such a fabulous thing, you know. And it was just appropriate. It was so appropriate. All of it was so appropriate. The film was just absolutely excellent. And I agree with you that Squires, I hadn't met Squires before, had chosen that final song was really good. All the songs were well chosen, at least all of the ones that were portrayed in the movie. You know, of course,
there is a Spotify playlist. You can search on Spotify for, like, Mars Rover Wake Up songs, and there is a playlist of all the songs that we used.
You can
judge our
time. Oh, cool. Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Sherry.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Listeners, we're about out of time, but if you hurry and you want to call, you can give it a shot. 866-687-7223. You know, Doug, I watched it on myself on my iPhone. And when I turned off the iPhone, all of my email and alerts and other stuff that comes in throughout the day and the night started popping up. It doesn't pop up when you're, you know, watching a film. And I live in Las Vegas, too. So the first thing I'm seeing is, I mean, it's really surreal, is neighborhood stuff coming in from the Ring doorbell, where they're hearing gunshots in their neighborhood and they're scared to death, and who else is hearing gunshots? Then I see police action in Henderson. It's a town a little south of Las Vegas. Then I see shootings in another place, and I'm starting to think of that old Dickens quote. So we just saw the best of time with what we can do with rovers, and the JPL team was a collection of people from all over, from different cultures, different races, and you know, they contributed and took us to Mars with these incredible rovers that really were like people. And then back here, you got all this crap going on. So it really is like Dickens, the best of time and the worst of time, and you really have a hard time understanding how disconnected we are from humanity and our potential by what we do to each other back here. And look at what we can do,
you know, millions and millions of miles away and what people can build. We didn't talk about how you had to make the launch schedule or you would have been set back 28 months and how hard it was to get everything ready and get it perfected to be able to make the launch window for Mars, even though you had years to prepare. You know, I'm sure Artemis couldn't have made the launch window for going to Mars. But I mean,
your point is very good. And I think it's one of the reasons that this resonates quite so well with people, that this film telling this story at this time. You know, the world is a little crazy. There is a lot that is, there's a lot of negative stuff around for a huge swathe of people for a huge swathe of reasons. There is a lot of bad stuff going on. But this reminds us that, hey, when we put our minds to it, we can do extraordinary things.
And we can do it together.
Commit to doing it, work together, and there is literally nothing that we cannot do. Think of what the Perseverance rover is about to start doing. And in terms of the working together, there is no better version of it than this, right? The Perseverance rover is getting ready to start dropping samples that it has found, collected, and documented and sealed up. It's going to start dropping those samples as a cache on the surface of Mars, right? It's going to lay out this library of priceless samples that another mission, several years from now, is going to go and launch. It's going to land right next to these, and then it's going to go pick them up. It's going to put them back into orbit around Mars, where it's going to meet a European-built orbiter, and that hardware will never have met before, right? This sample return canister with these samples that are trapped inside tubes that were being built 4 or 5 years ago, that have been on Mars for 2 years almost, they're all going to meet in orbit around Mars. It's going to bring them home. They're going to land on Earth, and we're going to be able to do the deepest dive into the geological history of Mars we've ever done, and the best chance we'll ever have of figuring out, you know, these environments that we have found, this kind of the geological record that we have found that says, hey, Mars was once an awful lot more like Earth. It was a habitable environment. We'll be able to pick these samples apart molecule by molecule and figure out if it was inhabited or not. And that is a huge endeavor. It's an extraordinary undertaking that only can come to pass through the kind of collaboration that brings out the best in all of us. And so your point on the diversity shown in this movie is a very, very good one, right? We do not lack pale white dudes, right, in the aerospace business. It takes everybody to do projects like this. And I'm glad that the movie highlights exactly how important that is. And it shows that when we come together, we can achieve almost anything.
It's quite a contrast. And I personally think JPL should be some kind of model or role model for our government. But that's probably asking for too much. But
the most entertaining version of how JPL can be a role model is we had a visiting speaker at JPL a few weeks ago. The head of research and development for the McLaren Formula One team was visiting JPL. And I'm going to be returning the favor. So in the spring, I'm going to be visiting the McLaren Formula One team and explaining how we operate our kind of high-performance vehicle that operates in an extreme environment. There are lessons to be learned in how we do this that can be applied across huge swathes of human endeavor.
Well, I definitely know there are lessons in how they protect humans that are driving those damn things and how you need to protect people in a spaceship. Nothing is better in safety than how those drivers are protected. Because you see some pretty crazy wrecks and airborne accidents and stuff, and drivers walk away from them. So there's a lot to be learned from how well they do.
And it's actually quite remarkable, but amazingly, this guy didn't actually realize this, but about 20 years ago, slightly more than 20 years ago, the McLaren Formula One team actually built hardware that is now on Mars, and it landed only about a week and a half before the Spirit rover did, because the McLaren Composites Department built the chassis of the British-built Beagle 2 Mars lander.
Huh.
And so they have wrecked hardware on the other side of the planet. Beagle 2, we think, landed intact but didn't successfully deploy after it landed. But that was actually the kind of the main chassis, the main structure of that spacecraft was actually built by McLaren in Woking outside London.
Is there any talk about the landing places where the two rovers are, Spirit and Oppy, to become historical places that nobody messes with? I know this argument for historical marks on the moon and elsewhere is one that's ongoing and has been around for a long time. But you'd almost hate for somebody to get there and interrupt those sites or interrupt those rovers. They should be there as part of a museum on Mars, in my opinion. Is there any talk about trying to establish that?
I don't think discussions have happened of that kind regarding Mars. I know discussions about a kind of Apollo landing sites.
Right.
Have kind of happened in a similar way. There are kind of some agreements in place to, you know, not disturb those landing sites. I can imagine a future. You know, we're on our, if you think about it, like you have Sojourner, Spirit, Opportunity. You have got the two original Viking landers, of course, in the 70s. You've got Phoenix. You've got Curiosity. You've got Insight. You've got Perseverance. You've got the Chinese rover, right? You've got future missions to come. It's not a large number of landing sites, but I certainly think that some kind of realization should be made that says these are sites of historical importance and that you need to strike a balance between sharing how important a place that is with also protecting it for posterity. Now, unlike the moon, like eventually through geological ages, you know, Neil and Buzz's footprints are going to be eroded through micrometeorite impact, but there's nothing we can do about that. And most of the wheel tracks that Sojourner and Spirit and Opportunity ever made have been blown away and are lost to the winds of time. But I do hope that at some point, kind of the landing site, the traverse, the important places where scientific discoveries were made, and the final resting places of these spacecraft will be marked in some way, will be protected in some way, be celebrated, but also used as a tool to inspire and educate and inform. I mean, I can imagine, you know, a 150 years from now, a school going to see where Opportunity came to rest and learning how we put together what constitutes the first overland expedition on another planet, right? There is potential for them to become incredibly powerful ambassadors. Even a century after their mission seems to be done, they can still be there to educate and inspire and inform. And they'll be there probably an awful lot longer than most other human endeavors.
Well, I see, Doug, how you ad-lib your remarks on the film. You definitely don't need to do a redo or a retake. And I think you just gave us a terrific closing for our program tonight, so I don't dare ask or bring up another topic because what you just said is so perfect. We'll just let it rest like Oppy and Spirit are resting. And I want to thank you very much for coming on and doing this and for Elizabeth and her crew because they worked really, really hard to arrange this show over a couple of weeks' time and especially the last couple of days. And I know this wasn't your usual publicity that you do, and I definitely appreciate it. I hope the listeners do, too. And I hope we get a chance to talk more to you with you about rovers down in the future because we're interested in them, and they're going to keep coming, and the more the merrier. So it's been great meeting you, and the film listeners, if you don't see it, you're not a true space cadet. I guess that's what I can say. Amazon
yes, hand in your space enthusiast card if you didn't do it.
That's right. hand it in. And make sure you see it. It's on Amazon Prime. I'm not advertising Amazon Prime, but I am advertising the film Goodnight Oppy. It's 105 minutes, and you won't take your eyes off the screen. And tell all the people that they just did a wonderful, wonderful job, and the people with the space show are really, really impressed and so glad that you documented it this way. And I do look forward to talking to you some more if you want to about rovers and new rovers coming up and new missions coming up. It's an incredible opportunity what we're doing with our planetary science program, and we really appreciate it. I hope all the country appreciates that it's very important. So once again, for the millionth time, thank you very, very much for all of what you've done and what you will continue to do.
It's been an absolute pleasure. It's been a great deal of fun. These some great questions, a great caller as well. It's never a dull time, and it's never a chore to get to share the adventures we have with our rovers. So it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this evening, Dave.
Thank you. Listeners, that's it for tonight. So Avi Loeb is with us on Friday live. He's only with us for a little over an hour. He has a new thesis and idea that sort of maybe negates the Big Bang Theory. So you might want to hear him talk about his new ideas on Friday. And there's new information on Mars. There's a paper published in Nature, and I have the lead author, Alexis, is going to be with us on Hotel Mars tomorrow. And his paper is on our blog if you want to get it from Nature. He's the lead author on what they're finding with sedimentary stuff on Mars. It's fascinating. And good night from Doug. Good night from Spirit and Oppie. I'm sure they send their good night wishes to us. And all of you. And as we like to say, keep looking up. And if it's clear where you are, you can see Mars near the moon. It's probably still in that location right now. And the week is young, so have a good week. Stay healthy. Play hard. And keep your sanity about you. Once again, thank you to Doug for being with us, Elizabeth for making this show possible. We really appreciate her efforts. And those of you who sent in emails, and for Sherry who called. Heads up, everybody. Good night from the space show.